Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Coffee and Open Source, a place to meet new friends, have some great conversations, and maybe learn something along the way. I'm your host, Isaac Levin. If you're enjoying the interviews here, be sure to like, subscribe, follow wherever you're watching or listening. Also, if you're interested or know any folks that would be interested in coming on chatting, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. My handle there is Isaac R. Levin. All right, so with that, I'm running out of coffee, but let's get to our guest. And I really want to get to my guest because we were talking offline about a couple of really exciting things. And today, I'm excited for my guest is Andy Piper. Andy, do you want to say hello? Introduce yourself.
Hello, Isaac. It's really exciting to be here. I was telling you before we came on online that I've been following the show for a while, and I've been excited to be invited. So thank you very much. My name is Andy Piper. I am a senior staff developer advocate at Twitter, and I guess I've been doing stuff around open source and software and technology for quite a long time. So it's been fun to listen to some of your other guests and see how their careers either match or differ from mine. So.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation too. And we'll get into a couple of the reasons why as we go throughout, as doing a little bit of research. I know I was talking to you beforehand about this, but I'm excited to kind of talk about some of, you know, a little bit of your background and some of the stuff that you've done and some of the stuff that you're doing now. I always like to start off my conversations with, you know, what's your tech origin story? So like, do you remember a particular point in time in your life? You might have been young, you might have been in school already, where you came across technology and you thought, this is it. This is what I want to be playing around with for the rest of my life or career.
So I started off with technology pretty young. My first computer was an Acorn Electron, which I think came out in 83 or 84. So that starts to date me. So I would have been 7, 8, 9 years old when I had one of those old 8-bit computers that you could just plug into the old CRT TV. It was just a keyboard and you had a cassette player to get your programs on. And I guess we had a bunch of cassettes and some early sort of 1980s video games on there. I remember before that, when I was at school as well, like there was a single Commodore PET, which was this huge hulking metal cased device that I don't remember. I'm either too old to remember what I thought when I was that young, or I just don't know what I was doing at the time. But I remember hanging around after school and just kind of hammering away on this keyboard with that. So I certainly have been around technology, but in a very small way, because it was back in the days when you were lucky if the school had one or two computers on site. Certainly when I went to what we call secondary school, so I guess that's high school in US terms, about 11, 12 years old, they had a room, the computer room, which had a number of computers that you could go and have a class that was specifically in that room. Again, they were all Acorn, BBC computers that were really popular in the UK back then. And back then, I started to work with a friend and write BBC Basic programs to solve problems. So I remember we had some software to learn chemistry, learn foreign languages. So literally just, you know, it would give you a word on the screen in a language, and then you just typed in the English version.
Sure.
So that was quite straightforward to write, but it was early days. And then we moved from the Acorn BBCs to the RISC, what they call the Acorn Archimedes and RISC computers. So this was when Acorn was starting to invent the ARM chips. It was Acorn RISC machines before it was Advanced RISC machines. So I still got somewhere in my old house, my mum's house, an Acorn RISC PC sitting there. Probably hasn't been powered on for 20 years. It's got all my old university essays on. But when I got to the point where I had to choose a set of subjects to do what we call at A-level in the UK, so this is the 2 years before going to college and to university, I had sort of both the school teachers on the sciences and on the arts both kind of vying to have me join their courses. And I was interested in all the things, really. I mean, we had chemistry software in that we were working with, and I was really interested in science. I'm particularly interested in chemistry more than biology and physics. There was no computing curriculum at all at the time. But I was always really fascinated by history. So I went and studied history, went to university to study history. And I definitely wanted to do computing around that, you know, but from my mid-teens. I knew I wanted to do something with technology. I went to school in Portsmouth in the UK, which is where IBM had one of its big locations. A lot of my friends' parents worked for IBM back then. IBM was a logo that I saw on a lot of PCs back in the late 80s.
Sure.
So that was definitely a brand I was familiar with. I grew into not, because I'd come from the Acorn world, I kind of grew into not loving Microsoft at that time. And then Linux came along in 91. And there was a sort of, everybody that wasn't using Windows was using something else. And that was Acorn or Amiga or something, non-Microsoft. So it took me a long time to sort of start doing stuff with Windows. When I went to university, I started helping in the computer room. Again, there was a room with a few computers where you got issued with an email address and a university email address, and it was just a text terminal using Pine and what I now know is Unix, but I didn't get told it was a Unix system. Sure. I was logging into. I was helping the other students. So I was kind of the outlier in terms of my education being on the social side and a historian and writing essays, but all of my friends being mathematicians and into computers. And we still, my friend and I, who were doing the software for languages and chemistry and stuff, we were selling some of our programs on 3.5 inch floppy disks to schools, because the BBC and Acorn computers were so popular in schools in the UK. And it turns out that we were just selling them at a flat rate and not charging a site license for the schools, you know, per seat, which a lot of the software vendors, big software, actual proper companies were selling. You know, if you bought a piece of software, you bought it for 100 students or whatever. Yeah. We were just selling licensing. A disk. Exactly. Yeah. We had no idea about that. So they loved our software because we just sold it for, I don't know, £20 or something on a single disk. And that was it. And we never had to deal with it again. I've been really into that. That's kind of all the way back to my origin story.
Sure.
The difficulty was getting from that in 1994 from a history degree into tech, because I wanted a job in tech, but very few companies or organizations were interested in somebody with a history degree at that time. So I kind of snuck in by getting an interview with the UK Post Office's IT division. So the people that are doing all of the computer infrastructure for the postal service, as a management trainee. So it wasn't at all a technical role. It was going to be going and learning to be an organizational manager on a graduate training scheme. And then I managed to build an access database to do some answer some, you know, internal problems. And people sort of thought, oh, he can drive a computer. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I've always, and thank you for that. That backstory, I think, is fascinating. And I want to talk specifically about the history thing in a second. But I think one of the things that you mentioned that I always think is very, very fascinating, especially with like tech folks, is that all of our friends or family or colleagues that aren't, like, I guess, more tech savvy or whatever phrase you want to phrase, they immediately gravitate towards you as, oh, you can help me with whatever I'm trying to accomplish, right? Like, you know, the cliche is like your help desk for your grandparents or whatever. There was a point in time where I feel like every one of my someone in my family had like an idea for an app. Like after the iPhone came out, they're like, I had this great idea for an app. I'm like, it's already taken. It's called Google Calendar.
Right.
But it's just very funny how like there's that dependency. Like I had a friend in college, and this is a little rant, but like, I literally had to fix their computer like once a week because, you know, they were a college kid and they would do terrible things on a laptop like most college people do. And I would just say, like, why don't you just learn like the basic levels of like keeping yourself safe?
Right.
He's like, well, why would I do that? I'll always be able to find somebody that knows more about computers than me. And I'm like, all right, that's fair. I mean, might as well focus on things that are a bit more important for you. But
yeah. I've definitely had that experience with my younger family members, my nieces and their friends, where they, you know, you can get them a brand new laptop and clean install it and give them just the bits they need, and they'll still install some dubious downloads from somewhere and end up with kinds of other nonsense going on that eventually grinds the machine to a halt. But back in the day, you know, when we were loading stuff from cassette tape back when I was a youngster, that was less of a problem. But yeah, for sure, I do tend to do a lot of family tech support. I don't hate it. Another thing I love is educating people, helping people, supporting people, working to explain things, make things less scary, and less of an invisible magical barrier, you know?
Yeah. Like the idea, like I was talking to, one of my kids' friends, and they were talking about Wi-Fi. And I was like, well, do you know actually what Wi-Fi is? And to them, Wi-Fi is the internet. So like internet connectivity is what is Wi-Fi. Like they don't understand that, like, you can actually plug computers in too. Like that whole idea is completely outside of their the whole like modem router thing. Like obviously this kid was like 7. So like, they're not going to explain all, but I was trying to explain to them that Wi-Fi is just one of the ways that you can get access to the internet. He's like, no, like I go to a place and there's a Wi-Fi and I connect to it and I have internet. And I mean, like the whole wireless, I guess, movement in the last 10, 15 years is pretty fascinating, solely because like it has completely eliminated the thought of like, oh, like I need to be like tethered to something to be able to communicate with the world.
For sure. I think the changing nature and format of computers and computing devices is amazing. When I was at IBM, my first job, I spent 4 years at the UK Post Office, gradually sort of becoming an engineer, a software engineer. And then I was lucky enough to be recruited into IBM as a sort of at that point, an experienced hire 4 years, sure. 4 years in. It was just after, actually, which is another interesting historical thing. I was at the UK Post Office when the year 2000 happened, and we needed to do all the testing around that. But I'll leave that little nugget hanging, and we can either come back to it or not, depending.
Oh,
but
we will.
But when I was at at IBM, we did a ton of work outreach with local schools, and this is fast forwarding another 10 years from then. So we're sort of end of the 2000s, and we were starting to do talks to young people about safety online, and information security. You know, you wouldn't leave your, you know, we do exercises about, you know, how easy it is to find out information about somebody based on their discarded paper mail envelopes, you know, on the assumption that people get paper mail, which of course we still do to some extent, but, you know, just about thinking about information security in the terms, in physical terms. And the kids were, as usual, far more savvy than we were expecting them or presenting them to be. More recently than that, my nieces, who are now young women, but when they were young ladies, they had, you know, they were interacting with mobile phones, touchscreen devices, as we've seen, as if these are magical sheets of glass, and then trying to deconstruct the magical piece of glass that's connected to the magical wireless internet to the fundamentals of, well, how can I take this back to, let's say, a laptop, and which is a computer, and a computer has a face or a screen and a brain or a CPU, and you know, trying to draw out all of the things that enable you to explain to a 2 to 5 year old perhaps, in our terms, because that's when we grew up and this is how these things had to be explained to us, how it all fits together. Whereas now they can buy for increasingly small amounts of dollars, incredibly, you know, highly capable devices that are just magical and just the expected way that things work. I also feel very grateful. I've been excited about coming to the show, partly because I knew that was your first question around the tech origin story. And I always think that I've lived through an amazing period of human history, because I've lived through the analog to digital era. I've lived on both sides of that divide before we had completely ubiquitous, fast, easy to use internet, where I would write physical letters to my relatives in Australia, and it would take a long time to get there, versus right now when I can talk to you, you know, across two continents. I feel really grateful for that. I feel really grateful that I have that experience and the ability to compare and contrast.
I've said this a few times. Like, I remembered all of my friends' phone numbers. I still to this day remember all of my friends' phone numbers. Like,
wow.
Now, like, you know, you ask anybody, it's like, oh, maybe you know your spouse or your partner's phone number. Like, it's hard. Like, so like that, I remember long phone cords. I remember the first time we got a portable like phone in the house. I remember my friends getting cell phones when we were younger, like, cause we'd go on a trip and it's like, oh, take this cell phone. Right. Because we need to be able to call on your way back or whatever. Like, I remember that. I remember the first iPod coming out. Like, I remember like all this crazy things. And now, and the reason why I set all that up is because, but my kid got a Chromebook for school.
Yeah.
And I set it up for, and I gave it to them and they're playing with it. And they come up to me and they said, Dad, there's something wrong with this Chromebook. And I said, what's the matter? Well, nothing happens when I touch the screen.
Yeah. Yep.
And I said, what do you mean? Like, are you, it's not a touch screen. No, it's got like, what do you mean it's not touchscreen? Like, everything's touchscreen. And yeah. I had this epiphany, like, you've never touched anything that didn't have a touch interface.
Mm.
Like a phone or a tablet or whatever, like, everything's been touch interface. So like the whole idea of a keyboard was completely foreign to them.
I always remember watching the Next Generation Star Trek in the late 80s and early 90s and thinking as well about the kind of Wesley Crusher, how can this kid be so fantastically smart when, you know, in order to get to, you know, the kind of levels of physics that show is portraying, you've got to have all these other fundamentals nailed by the age of, you know, 6 months. It's fascinating how the world moves along, because back in the day, again, going before both of our times, you know, the printing press was not a thing that people were used to. So it does just become eventually part of the fabric, I guess.
It's fascinating. And we were talking about this a little bit before we started about how like the window for like this, all this innovation in tech is so much smaller. We were talking about like things like the Enlightenment or the Industrial Revolution and all these like moments in human history where it's like, oh, okay. Like, we came out of the Dark Ages and now we did this thing, like, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And at least, you know, in my or your lifetime, we've gone literally from this to now we have like these silly devices where I can literally get access to any piece of information that's ever existed in human history. And I play Candy Crush on it. Right. Because why not? Yeah. And I'd love to kind of dove into that sort of conversation about like your fascination with history and then how that ties into tech, because I think, I have a little bit of an interest in history as well, solely because I truly believe that it's probably the most fascinating thing that humans have ever like had an idea of, like, oh, let's keep track of everything that we've done over the course of time. And not even just that, but let's actually specialize in looking back and seeing those things. And you have all these different like specialties like that are, I guess, liberal studies type of degrees or social sciences degrees where they're they're not focused on history. They're focused on the history of the origins of people.
Yeah.
The history of literature. The history, obviously, in like global geopolitics. Like
that stuff came up in my university interview. They were asking me. I remember them asking me sort of about, you know, the value of history as compared to studying the history of a specific slice, you know, economy of Spain or whatever. I don't know. I guess I'm fascinated. And this ties into one of my roles in developer relations as a public speaker. I guess I'm just fascinated by stories. And that's not very much not in a fictional way. It's, I love reading fiction and all kinds of entertainment that come from storytelling. But I think the ability to understand and weave a story and know the fundamentals is really amazing to me. I don't know where it came from. I just was always really interested in history. I studied modern history and classical civilizations. So that's Romans and Greek sort of civilizations back at school. And then I went on to study modern history, and primarily around, so the history degree I did, I had to cover the majority of British history from roughly the year 900 to 19. I'm pretty sure everything ended in 1956 when Stalin died. I think pretty much when I was at school, all of the history courses decided that history ended at 1956. And after that, you were into politics or modern studies or something else. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, mostly that was then. The one thing I regret was that I never specialized or really got to know American history. I studied as a separate subject, as a separate thing. I was familiar with some of the bigger events, especially as they impacted the UK.
Sure, sure.
But obviously I've learned a lot, and I'm still interested in all of those things. But I specialized more in European empires back when I was studying. And beyond that, it is just an interest. I mean, I haven't written books or spent a ton of time. I don't spend my free time reading history books. It's just something I love that I have as a foundation and a background, and that I'll keep up with and, you know, learn how people are reanalyzing events based on, you know, newly discovered information. I find the ability for science to progress archaeology and discover stuff that was undiscovered previously. Unfortunately, right now it's climate change, which is often uncovering things that we weren't aware of, you know, had previously lost. But I find all of that really interesting as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that fascinates me most about history is that, like, history, for whatever reason, and I'm guessing, you know, it's just because it's easy, but it's always organized into specific categories, right? Like, you just did it. Like, you're like, oh, everything, like, you know, we have history before, like, before Stalin died, and you have, like, modern history, right? Yeah. So, like, history is always placed into these buckets.
Yeah.
So whenever you're talking about things, like, it's not just – because there's so much topic to cover. There's so much content that exists in the history world because it's literally every second in the history of civilization. But, you know, to tie that back into something about tech is, like, we're very guilty of it too in tech, where it's like, oh, like, you know, do you remember Web 2.0?
Yeah.
Or do you remember the era of the iPhone, or, you know, Windows 3.1? Like, you have all these, like, you know, I guess milestones or checkpoints in the history of technology. And it's so similar to me when I think about, like, how we chronologize history too. Like, I guess you would say non-tech, just general history.
Yeah, I think you're right about that categorization. And I kind of see it as ways of dividing up knowledge and information to make it more understandable. Certainly when I left thinking back to when I left university and then coming through my career from then, I tend to tie particular things to a particular number of years after university for myself. So that's even sort of setting those same categories. So, oh, I worked at that employer when those things happened. The other interesting thing, just to reconnect and possibly close it off, to the Y2K thing I mentioned earlier, because I've now worked with coworkers who are not familiar with the concept that there was a problem in the year 2000 with computers. Sure. But, you know, we were talking before we started recording about, you know, those who don't pay attention to history are doomed to repeat it, or whatever the phrase is. And of course, the problem with year 2000, as people who may or may not know if they're listening or watching, a lot of computer systems were assuming that dates, the date for a year would be the last two digits of the four digit year. And thus, you know, lots of systems were built around that principle. And we had to test everything that when the year went from 99 back to 00, it wasn't going to break all of the systems. And actually working in the UK post office, where lots of things are very time and location dependent, that was a really big deal. For a period of time. So we had to do about a year and a half of testing of all the systems to make sure they weren't all going to break. But here we are in 2022 with a problem looming in the Unix kernel, which is also time oriented. It's not two digits, it's 2038, but we don't seem to have moved past that yet still. And that problem creeps ever closer. So It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's always time, right? Like they have like the silly phrase, like it's always DNS. Yeah. I think if it's not DNS, it's time.
Yes.
And obviously if everybody followed the exact same time, placeholder, like it would be substantially challenging to figure things out. But
A lot of our security systems most of our security systems are 100% time-based, right?
Yeah.
So whether it's one-time authenticators or whether it's, OAuth or whatever, you've got some time element in there that if things are not sufficiently synchronized, then it's not going to work. So yeah, you're quite right.
I remember like this being a problem with operating systems like Mac or Windows a few years, like if the time ever got out of sync, with like the real time and your system time, like things would just stop working. And I remember especially like on Windows, like you would have to like resync the time servers, right? Like just because somebody actually had to think like, okay, well, if these two things get not connected or disconnected in some way, like we're going to have a bad time. So create a button on some Windows form somewhere inside of Windows says just resync with our time server.
Right.
Like, it's just so fascinating to me that like that sort of workaround has to exist because of, like you said, the problem that occurs when things get out of sync, which is completely fascinating to me.
So this isn't as going to be as useful for the podcast version of the show, but the video version, I've got here a little vacuum tube style LCD LED clock that was a Kickstarter. It's running an ESP32 chip inside, so it's got Wi-Fi and Bluetooth built in. It connects to my home network, synchronizes to NTP. I can change out the screens and the displays, and the last panel can have a weather display on it. And it's kind of fun. It's got that mix of retro style. It's also very nicely made. It's got a lovely wooden base and a nice weighty base as well. But then we come on to things that I'm also interested in around Internet of Things and small chips and programming those kind of bits of hardware. I just thought it was talking about time, I thought it was a fun interlude, I guess.
No, I mean, like, it's funny you mentioned something that has nothing to do with tech other than the fact that it's like I'm very guilty of it too. Like, depending on the weight of something is how I grade the quality.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
There's definitely something to that, right? Like, if you have flatware, like forks or knives, like, has to have, like, a proper weight and a balance to it.
Yeah, no, I have a number of issues with this device, not least the fact that they said the software was going to be open source, and it's not yet. So a bunch of us have been reverse engineering it. I have also fully disassembled it myself because it's me, and it is actually quite nicely made. So yes, you are quite right, because I know that certain headphones, I believe, where there was some thing about them having weight in them or something to make them feel more premium. But this is a nice little thing.
Yeah, and maybe there's something to do with like the fact that, like you said, like the quality of the craftsmanship. Like if you can take like a denser material and make it satisfying instead of just like putting like two very very I think it's all mental gymnastics, I think. But I think one thing that's very very interesting that you just said about like the IoT space, like obviously makers, the whole idea of IoT, the idea of like, oh, I have an idea, let me put it on a Raspberry Pi or some other small chip, like that's something that fascinates me. Obviously you just said it fascinates you. Like, is it just because a lot of people in tech are also tinkerers? Like, we just like to, like, obviously we write software all day, or we're, administering systems or whatever it is. Like, sometimes we just like to keep our hands dirty.
I think there's an element of that. And for me, that's definitely part of my story personally, because with that old Acorn Electron that I had back in the 80s, my parents got really annoyed with the beeps and boops it would make when I was playing games. And I figured out how to take the case apart, cut the speaker out and wire in an old pair of Sony Walkman headphones to directly into it, and then put a little switch in so that it would actually let me switch between the speaker or the headphone. So I've certainly been interested in that myself for a long time. And then fast forwarding through that other part of our conversation around iPhones and smart devices, today all of that stuff is so glued and closed and difficult to modify, that when something like Raspberry Pi came along, incidentally invented by somebody, Eben, who has a somewhat similar view of life, because he also grew up on the BBC Micros in Cambridge in the 1980s, that, you know, hardware should be understandable and open and give people the ability to tinker. My involvement is both a connection that goes back to when I was a kid liking to play with electronics, also having met Eben and Liz from the Raspberry Pi folks from when they just still had their prototype boards, not before it had been launched. So I made a video. We met at an event in Oxford, actually. Raspberry Pi has just gone past 10 years, so it must have been about 12 years ago. And I made a video of them showing how they had this little credit card size prototype device that was still pushing HD video, which was amazing. And that's one of my most popular ever YouTube videos. It was just a recording of these people showing something running an HDMI output. But also, when I was at IBM, I got very involved with messaging technology. So I spent 10 years at IBM after the post office, primarily as a messaging middleware consultant, and then moved into the IoT and this protocol called MQTT, which IBM was in the process. They'd released the specification as open, but they hadn't sort of formally open sourced their own code and sort of made it clear that this thing was totally free to use. And there was a sense of suspicion that IBM was trying to get people onto their proprietary middleware through a back door by getting people to use this open source thing that would then get subsumed. So I became sort of one of the first advocates for that technology, early advocates really, because there were a bunch of other people doing cool stuff in that space. But I didn't leave IBM until they open sourced and gave it to the Eclipse Foundation as a thing. I was the first project lead for that. So I love tinkering and these small boards. I spend way too much on AliExpress getting lots of the latest little circuit boards to flash with this stuff. It's also a great teaching tool, because if you give youngsters something small and approachable that they can easily plug things in and out of and write some code either in a graphical tool like Scratch or make code or starting to learn, move into learning Python and other languages, it can be really engaging.
I totally agree. I think also you haven't made it until you have a drawer full of Raspberry Pis that you had an idea to, I'll buy a Raspberry Pi, I have this cool idea for it, and now that drawer is full of Raspberry Pi
Pico. It's called our dining.
Yeah.
It's called our dining table, and that's why we don't eat in the dining room anymore. I've genuinely been thinking about trying to hire a workshop space because I have far too many gadgets. Plus, I want a 3D printer and I don't have one yet. And I don't have room for one because I have too many gadgets in this house.
Yeah, so I had a 3D printer and then I bought another 3D printer, one of the ones that you kind of build yourself.
Yeah.
And then I realized this is too big. So the whole thing's the current 3D printer I have has a smaller, plate on it, so you can't really make large things. So I'm like, oh, I want to be able to make large things. And the first thing my wife said when I said I was going to buy it is like, what large thing are you going to make? And I just lived up.
It's one of those leading questions that where this is going.
No, she just knew I didn't have an answer. So when I got it, I made a couple of large things. What did I make? Just random trinkets that I ended up have been donated to the recycling bin. But it's funny because then I eventually sold the larger one and now I have the smaller one. I don't use that either. I'm very guilty of picking up hobbies and over hyper fixating on hobbies and then never doing those hobbies again.
Sounds a lot like my hobby to-do list as well, but I've bought far too many boards that I had a plan for and I haven't progressed with, but I'm making some progress with a few things. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah, one of the things that you said that I love as well about Raspberry Pis or smaller IoT devices, the accessibility to them, right? Being able to create really cool things and not spend a bunch of money doing it, right? There's there's tons of Kickstarters that have been created, like, oh, let's just, let even though the Raspberry Pi is accessible, let's make it even more accessible. Let's have a completely, like, you know, plug-and-play interface that you can plug into monitors and all this sort of stuff. And I've bought into a couple of them, and it's just amazing, like, some of the stuff that you can do on such a small little device, right? Like, it's very, very fascinating. And two, like, it's just, I don't know, there's something at least that in my brain, like, if I can see, like, if I can turn a light on and off with some code, or if I can make a little car move across the thing with code, like, that in my brain, I'm like, oh, like, that is satisfying. You know, where else, I'm just, when I'm tricking sand on a computer to do smart things, like, that's not as exciting for me.
I love that phrase, tricking sand on a computer. That's amazing. Definitely. I think one of the things that I get a lot of pleasure from, but also on the flip side, get some disappointment from, frustration from, is observing how those success stories as Kickstarters grow their communities or not, and therefore have an ongoing life or not. So I've definitely seen both sides of that with, for example, this clock. I'm still hopeful that the folks that created it will ship the source code. But even if they don't, it's an ESP32 in there, so people could write their own and reflash it. It'd be easier if we knew exactly how. But right now, the community is excited because we've already reverse engineered the web interface and figured out how we can change just the graphics. So people are already, there's a Facebook group where people are sharing new pictures, and that gives content, which becomes a gives you a pipeline of content to keep the community interested. I think that there are other devices that I've backed and had high hopes for where the obvious next step to me, because I come from the background of sharing what I've learned and posting my code and learning from other people's code, is for them to encourage a community around it. Now, that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of patience, and it can take time. And not everybody is immediately on board with it. In the sense of, you know, some people just want to have bought a thing and learn how to use it. Other people want to immediately go and tell everybody what they've done and built and so on. So I've got another couple of devices. This is one was from an organization called Crowd Supply. This one is called the Newt, and it is it's a lovely e-paper, beautiful sharp e-paper display. It's not e-paper. It's a sharp display, similar looking to e-paper. So it's got the same sort of qualities. It doesn't have a lot of reflectivity, and it's very low power, but it's not the same as e-paper. If I turn the power off, it will lose the display. It won't hold it. But the other thing is that, again, this runs on, I think, an ESP32. The guy has released all the code for it. It's an Arduino-based project. And he quite quickly, after shipping his devices to people, his design was already on GitHub, because that's how he built up the project and got people interested. I suggested to him that he start a GitHub discussions forum so people can share ideas. He can share what he's doing as he's building the software. We can ask questions. That's still in its early stages as well. But I find it really interesting to see how people embrace the hardware or the tools and things, and then extend them or not, or just share how they're using them. You know, where is this thing in your house? How do you use it every day? What's the daily utility of that to you? If I could see the latest tweet from somebody I follow on that kind of display as I passed, as I glanced at the time, that would be interesting, because there's far too many tweets in the world for me to read all of them.
That's very true. I think you mentioned something too, like the whole idea of, like, oh, just put the code on GitHub, or like, why can't you open source the code? Like, it's very, very interesting. Like, how, you know, going back to history, like how we got to this point. Like, I remember carrying around floppies. I remember carrying around USB drives. I remember when like online storage came out, like, oh, like I would just put all my projects in like Google Drive. And then it's like, oh, okay, well, every time you do a build, like, that's a horrible experience because things get updated and whatever, right? And now we have this website that you can just go to, put your source code, everybody has access to it, and it's great. At the same time, now there's almost like an expectation that's like, if you're not on GitHub, if you're not open source, you're doing something wrong, which I always think is a very interesting juxtaposition.
I think there's some really interesting stuff in this space as well, especially with the retro computing community that I'm also taking interest in. So there's a ton of people that build stuff around Z80, old Z80 chips, and build sort of 8-bit computers. And literally, I've tried hand soldering mine. Mine does not work yet. I'm still troubleshooting. I'm literally going through and checking every pin and all that sort of thing. But other people have been very successful. Some of that code is on GitHub, but a lot of other folks just share it in zip files in forums. Now, I'm not advocating for GitHub as the single source of where everything should be shared, because I'm also very aware that single sources of information can go away or have other problems. So I definitely understand. I love using it because it has a ton of features and they just seem to keep improving them. But I'm also quite quietly kind of sensitive to those kind of, that keeping a broad and diverse and open community is another thing that's important to me. I come from the Ubuntu community in the past. I've done a load of work in there. I believe in the open web. I believe in web standards. I believe that anybody should be able to build a website without having to know a ton of stuff around how to deploy all of this stuff at a technical level. So accessibility, we were talking before the show about, the assumption that everybody should have a GitHub account and just automatically know how it works and what to do when you go on GitHub. Yeah. It's not that straightforward. I've got a community that I got involved with quite recently. It's called Together We Open Source, and it's a meetup group. And Nikita, the person that's been hosting that currently, has been helping people to sort of navigate their first pull request and learn what to do on GitHub. When you go there, figure out how to contribute, how you might improve something. And it was a great reminder to me, being on a Zoom session with him and some other folks, that not everybody knows these things by default. I'm definitely one of those privileged people that has got a background that has helped me to level up to a certain point. So I do always love to be reminded to step back, think, what if I knew nothing in this space, whether it's to do with GitHub or the Twitter API or anything related to technology in particular. What if I was coming at this fresh? How would I expect this to work? What should I expect it to work? Not to have expectations as far as possible. Really important as well as a developer advocate when writing technical documentation or tutorial information for people to help them get started, because my goal as a developer advocate is to listen to their challenges, find answers for them, and then help them to get started and stay engaged rather than just to try a thing and then walk away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could talk about developer advocacy for hours, right? Like, think the whole idea of it, at least in my opinion, is I am out here trying to not just make the lives of the current developer, but also the future developer, also myself. If I can enable somebody to be enthusiastic enough about technology, they could create something that could better my life, right? And that's a gross summarization of what I think developer advocacy really means to me. But I think it's very, very exciting when you think about the amount of potential that every person has if they have an interest in technology, right? Regardless if you're, a Go developer, or you're building stuff with Kubernetes, or you're playing around with IoT devices, or you're writing assembly, right? It doesn't matter, right? At the end of the day, we all have something to give to this community.
Yeah.
Right. If we want to. And it's okay if you want to just make a paycheck working in tech, that's cool for you.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Actually, that reminds me, you asked earlier something that reminded me about somebody I used to work with at IBM, who's a really good friend of mine, but he literally did live the job. He's a brilliant techie. He helped us. There were three of us that tended to work together quite often on different things. And we created one of the fastest transaction processing systems for one of the UK banks, which was very cool. And he did a lot of the sort of machine code optimizations to enable that. But his home life was very much, that's it, I'm done with tech. I'm not going to be on email. I'm not going to have a mobile phone. I'm going to go and listen to classical music with my wife and do other things.
Yeah.
And he's remains an excellent friend of mine and an incredibly smart person. But I found it, as somebody who's somebody who is as enthusiastic as I am about technology and has and someone who has embraced it as part of my hobby and lifestyle, it's also a great reminder to me that not everybody lives that lifestyle. Yeah. Not everybody lives like me. Not everybody thinks the same way or has the same background. Yeah, it's very humbling just to stop and think about those things as I do.
It's definitely a challenge, right? Like, you know, I think there's this joke that my wife and I always used to make. It's like, it's hard for adults to make friends, right? Mm. But I think it's also harder for adults that only like to talk about certain things to make friends. Like, I mean, yeah. I follow sports. I like music. I like going to the theater. I like movies. I like all these things, right? But like most of the conversations that I want to have some sort of technology spin to them, right? And it becomes really challenging because I have friends that are in tech too that do the job. I also have friends that aren't in tech that, you know, when I try to have, you know, they ask, like the question that I always have a problem answering is like, okay, so like how was your day at work? Or, you know, what do you do? Because I immediately want to go so deep that everybody's going to drown if they can't swim with me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's really, really challenging.
Yeah, definitely. I can understand that. It was also reminds me of a career development moment for me, which was becoming a consultant at IBM when I was 24 years of age, I think 25. And suddenly realizing that I was going as the representative of this big corporation every day or different weeks to a different customer and different company, sure. and needing to build a relationship with them very fast. And I am not the kind of person who typically has either excelled at or loved sports. There's a few that I will watch and enjoy, but it's not been something I've really kept up with. But I quickly learned in that role to develop my social skills and develop my knowledge of other stuff that was beyond my comfort zone and interest, you know, my obvious interest areas. So I had a really fast development period when I joined that team and that company, where I was going to different customers regularly because I was looking at different technical problems in different technology stacks and having to become an expert in them very fast, but also having to build trust, interpersonal trust, very quickly when a software vendor, back in the days when a lot of that software vending was literally sending a stack of CDs to a place and having to, you know, load them one by one into a Unix system and install all the stuff, was the software vendors were very often seen as adversaries rather than helpers and supporters enablers. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, you have two purposes, right? Your purpose is to help them spend money and also buy them drinks and food. Like, that's a thing too. Like, I've worked in client-facing space before, and it's like the real work is building, like you said, building that trust, showing folks that you have empathy. Like, I think people talk about empathy all the time, but I said there's, like, in tech specifically, there's so much empathy that's needed because, like we were talking about earlier, the whole spectrum of people are in tech. The whole spectrum of people are interested in tech. And it's very, very important to consider that your experience might not be the same as somebody else's. I struggle with that all the time. And it even gets you more challenging when I talk with non-technical folks for that sole reason, because my wife, she knows a little bit about technology and she can like do some HTML and stuff, but like it's like she has no interest in ever being a software engineer. And I was talking to her about a challenge that I was facing technically, and she said, well, it sounds to me like that's just something that it's not even worth it. Like, it's too, like, because I was like, it was like trying to like move like a text box like 5 pixels over and also have like responsive design. And I was like, okay. And she's like, it sounds like something that doesn't matter to anybody but you. I'm like, but it matters to me. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, empathy is the number one thing that I've listed when people have asked me about what you need to work in developer relations as well, for sure, just that understanding that comes from outside of yourself, really, that the that comes from really watching and observing and listening to other people's challenges, and yeah, quite often taking that sort of contrary view, right? Almost a deliberately contrary view to yourself, just so you can see what it's like on the other side. Yeah, really cool.
I would love to, you know, as we're, you know, tailing off towards the end, I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that you like you said, you're a developer advocate at Twitter. I'd love to kind of hear, you know, some of the work that you're doing and enabling the developer community and some of the things that you've seen recently in that space. I would love to hear some of it.
Thanks for the asking. I've been at Twitter for 8.5 years, and I'm extremely grateful for that. One thing that I find really interesting about Twitter, I've been using it myself since 2007, so the year after it came out, right?
Are you allowed to be in tech and not use Twitter? Are you allowed? They'll take away your technology card, right?
Something we spoke about, I think, before we started recording was how everybody uses social media today, but not everybody uses Twitter. Lots of people use lots of different platforms, and it can be difficult to keep up. And I don't have some of those accounts on some of those platforms because I just haven't got to them yet. But yeah, that's a great question. But for me, fundamentally, it has changed my life. It got me my previous job, which was at VMware working on Cloud Foundry, the platform as a service. And then through, you know, my exposure as a developer advocate on Twitter, then I got invited to the role at Twitter, which was amazing. But one of the fascinating things about Twitter as a platform and an API is that when the API first came out, they just kind of didn't really think it through. 6 months after they started this thing that let you post an SMS message to a web page, which is how it started, one of the founders kind of said, well, why don't we just, you know, make the API, tell everybody how to post this stuff technically on without using SMS. So they just wrote this little about page with a bunch of fragments of XML on it that said, this is how to hit the API. And people built libraries around it.
Yeah.
The company never launched their own libraries. And if they had launched the libraries in 2006, what languages would those libraries have been in? I'm guessing PHP. Almost certainly. My first app I wrote against Twitter's API in 2007-08 was in PHP for sure. Probably Ruby. Twitter itself started off in Ruby. I don't know what other languages they might have shipped, but they wouldn't have shipped Rust libraries, or they wouldn't have shipped, you know, Flutter and some of the frameworks that are really popular today. So the community has been really central. So I spent quite a few months, a couple of years ago, going through and figuring out as many libraries as possible that the third-party developer community had built, find out where they were, who was using them, how popular they were, just really go and look and talk to those developers. And then as we moved from the version 1.1 of our API to version 2 more recently in the last couple of years, try to connect with those developers and see if they were interested in continuing to migrate their code, because it was a big change after 12 years or so of version 1.1, or not. So my passion and interest really in the last couple of years has been identifying where those developers are, going chatting with them in their own spaces. Some are on their own Discord or Slack servers. Sure. Some are on GitHub. Even if their code is on GitHub, they maybe have their own mailing lists or chats in other places. Just trying to keep aware of where people are, give them some support when I can. Help them out, encouragement, appreciation, appreciation, because being a developer who's building on a platform, any platform, where the platform themselves doesn't necessarily ship their own libraries, can be a thankless task, right? But I appreciate it, and a number of other people appreciate that work. So that's what I have kind of specialized in. There's a ton of other things I've been working on around documentation, tutorials, working with my colleagues who are putting a lot of content on sites like Dev, right? So the practical developer Dev, the folks that build Forum, I've got involved in their community. Earlier today, I joined one of their moderator hangouts that was on their Discord because I know their community lead. And I know that a lot of developers go to sites like that to consume information, learn from those kind of things. So just wanting to understand where developers are, and help them be successful. That's really what developer advocacy for me. It's developer advocacy is so many things we both already said, but that's one of the things I love about developer advocacy, and it's one of the things that I love about working in the company I work at, because I've gone from history, I've learned a ton of stuff about technology along the way, but all the time it's been about interest in people. So I've landed at this point in my life in a place where really technology and people come together, and a global community comes together. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter constantly. I think you said one thing that was very interesting, I'd love to talk about just for a second, is like, you know, we're talking about a little bit offline about like, you know, should big company do said thing because they see an opportunity as, you know, oh, we need to capture the minds of all these sort of technologists, right? And you said something that was very, very interesting. It's about, you know, giving support for folks that are building these third-party tools, right? Like, if I'm a developer and I'm, say, for instance, I do a lot of developer stuff with Twitter because I'm a .NET developer advocate and I do a lot of stuff with Twitter. So I use a third-party library that exists and it's amazing and I love it. But it's not from Twitter, right? I love it because that one person cared enough to build the thing because they saw a gap for what they were trying to accomplish. And now they've enabled all these other people that have similar needs to be able to do the thing they want to do. And that's it.
It's a really fine line to walk because there's a couple of dimensions to it. One of them is our platform is built on a number of technologies. So naturally we could, in principle, ship libraries in those languages and those technologies, but it's very unlikely that we'll know a lot of the other languages that exist and technologies that exist outside of our platform that people still want to use. So then we could either outsource that development or hire a bunch of people just to maintain that library or leave it to the community. The other danger or the other thing that I'm aware of is exactly what you just said, that you've got individuals or groups of people who care enough that they've invested their time and effort in building something that works well, documented it, shared it, support it. If then that company come out and release something that's in a similar space, in a similar language, why should that be preferred by the community? I've always found that really fascinating from when I was at IBM all the way through to today. Why would you choose a specific option? And I really think it's about popularity because that's going to drive a lot of the interest and support, community support for that thing. Lots of other materials that you can be producing, like tutorials. If a company has their own particular preferred stack, then they're going to spend a lot more time building materials around that and not investing in other areas. I find it amazing that the companies have the opportunity to scale via engagement with community, right? And take their platforms and technology to places it would never have been. That started in my life, going all the way back to sort of MQTT, which was very much at one point an internal IBM Java and C implementation, and now exists in, you know, a variety of flavors. And not only that, there are a variety of open source servers and commercial servers you can go and choose from. And it's one of my, honestly, it's one of my greatest sort of small pleasures in life to look back at that thing that I spent a couple of years of my life shouting about on Twitter aggressively and going to open source meetups to talk about and show off. But now I barely have to, you know, open Twitter to see a ton of people who I've never come across before. There was a point in time when I probably would have known everybody that knew anything about MQTT, and now there's millions of people that don't I've not met yet. It's amazing. So I love the opportunity that community can provide, and I really struggle with the company ownership as a means of control and arguably quality control for a thing versus what the community can provide if they're well supported.
I agree with everything you just said. Like, I have literally no really... comments. No, I mean, that's great. Like, and it's substantially more succinct, I think, than I would ever be able to elaborate. So I really appreciate that, because it's really, really important to think about, we all need to pick our battles, right? And I think, you know, whether you're a couple hundred thousand employee tech company or you're one individual, you need to decide on the things that matter to you. And if some of the, and if you want to spend your time as a developer building some tool, you should be empowered and a champion to do that. And I think as long as we can continue down that path, it's only going to, you know, bear fruit, to use a cliche, for, you know, the next generation or the, or even the current generation in tech.
I think it's really interesting and challenging, especially when the two sides come together, whether there's something that is arguably not open or has reasons to have protections around it, security surfaces around it.
And then the
open source community, because then you get to a point of, as long as you follow a certain set of rules, we're all good. But at the same time, you've got the elements that come from open source around learning more than you knew before, right? That you didn't realize that wasn't working as well as it could. But it's fascinating. I'm really grateful for some of the folks I've worked with in open source, in Twitter, that have subsequently moved on. Will Norris, Julia Farioli, some other folks that have worked in open source spaces with me have just been really great to work with. And I've also had a history with the Eclipse Foundation through MQTT, and I'm grateful for those relationships, because the open source space as a whole, and this is another one of those things we could have spent a whole conversation on instead of just 20 seconds, is facing some fascinating challenges around software bill of materials, security of software stacks when one maintainer is involved, all of those kind of things, right? And how you reward people for work, which may just be a game or a hobby or literally a piece of pleasure for them.
Yeah.
Oh, because I've been in situations where I've thrown out some code with the intent of building a community around it, but actually it was a weekend project.
Yep.
And then I've had people sending me direct messages on Twitter wanting me to help them with the code that I put on GitHub. Mm-hmm. And my immediate thought is, well, why couldn't you have just asked on GitHub instead of direct messaging me? Because that feels really direct. But also, oh, I don't really have time for this right now. Quite involved in it right now.
Yeah. I've talked about this all the time, right? Like the I have a problem, I needed to get it solved. I'm very guilty of it too. I don't direct message open source maintainers, because I tend to go the opposite approach, where I try to make something work myself so much to the effect that it's a waste of time.
Right.
Like, instead, because I think that it's better to waste my own time than somebody else's time. Which you could say a lot about me in that regard. But I think one of the things that's, you mentioned something about, like, it's the side project or the hobby. Like, maybe that person doesn't want it to be anything more than that.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
And like, you know, you start having, you know, people who work at X company. Oh, we're dependent on this now. Oh, yes. Like, we want somebody to from our company to contribute to your project. Well, no, I kind of like did it in a weekend, and like, I don't even want beer money.
Like, yeah, throwing money and people out of problem is not always the answer, for sure. Yes.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, a good place for us to wrap up. I've really enjoyed the conversation that we've been having about the community and tech and all these sort of things. It's really been fascinating. And to talk a little bit about history too, which I always really enjoy. So Andy, do you want to, you know, do you have anything as we part? Do you have any parting words or things that you'd like to leave at the end?
Always be curious. Always try to be empathetic. If I can just plug my own content for a moment, I've been co-hosting a podcast called gamesatwork.biz, which has taken a couple of forms, but currently called gamesatwork.biz. For 10 years with a couple of my former co-workers from IBM, and we get together on a Friday to record to release on the Monday, just to talk about tech and gaming and virtual worlds and work and all kinds of stuff in general. It doesn't get as deep and techy as we've been on this show. It's a lot more consumer facing, I guess.
Yeah, but, sure.
I really enjoy this kind of opportunity. Stay safe, stay curious, be respectful of one another. That's my final parting thought.
Excellent. Yeah, and we'll be sure to put a link to games@work.biz in the show notes, because I think, you know, I'm a huge consumer of podcasts. Like, I listen to podcasts from all sorts of different genres because I need to have something in my ear, and I really don't like coffee place sounds that people sometimes do, or that sort of thing. So we'll be sure to put some of that in the show notes.
Thank you.
So you have listened to the show before, so you know how the show usually ends. So when I love to finish my conversations with my guest, I like to ask them if they could summarize their thoughts or opinions or feelings about tech and open source, and they only had one word to do so, what would that mean for you? And you can cheat. I'll let you cheat.
No, I'm just going to use the word creativity.
That's great. That's perfect. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Andy, for being on the show today. This was a pleasure. I think we have enough content that was left on the table to do another one of these. So maybe we'll figure out something in the future to do another one.
Awesome. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in or listening. It's been a pleasure. My name is Isaac Levin. This is Andy. Thank you so much for tuning in to Coffee and Open Source. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.